You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Carissa St. Laurent. She and I chat about her choice to stop binge drinking in her 40s, and we talk about what her life was like before and after she made that choice, that change. We also talk about sourdough bread and chocolate. Yum. Are you ready? I'm ready. Let's go. Carissa St. Laurent, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
It's so wonderful to be here, Amy. Thanks for having me.
I'm happy you're here. Are you welcome? Ready for a wonderful chat?
Yes, so ready.
Me too. So I start every interview asking people where they're calling in from, where they're talking to me from. Where in the world are you?
I'm in Northwest Arkansas.
Northwest Arkansas, with a name like Carissa St. Laurent, I was not going to guess Arkansas. I was not.
And with a face like this, and yeah, I don't. It's a story, in and of itself that we won't get into. But I love it here. It's beautiful. It's really, there's a lot of nature. It's gorgeous. I grew up in New Hampshire, so small town nature is I'm used to that.
That is spectacular. Very good. So I love to learn about my guests as people, in addition to where they live. I'm going to ask you a question, surface level, no pressure. What's a hobby or a pastime that you enjoy and you're willing to share with us?
Oh, yeah, that's a good caveat to the willing to share. I love making sourdough bread. And fairly newish hobby that I got into this year, not the COVID sourdough bread time when everyone got into it then. I just got the confidence recently to start doing it. It's one of those feels like it's harder than it actually is hobbies. And I absolutely love it. I do it every week. It's an amazing feeling. And it's also an incredible result to get to eat it after.
I also make sourdough bread once or twice a week. So I've been doing it a little over a year, just like you. I did not start it during lockdown when we were apparently supposed to be doing that, but it came into my life a little later. Luckily, though, I have some friends who did it during lockdown and they were able to answer my questions and share their recipes with me. So I felt like I took the benefit of it without having to go through that. But I agree. I think it's fun. That, you know, it's not a fast process.
No, that's what I love about it.
Yeah.
That there's so much, it slows me down because I'm going a mile a minute often. And so it's that, slowing down process. It's very visceral when I spend so much time on a screen and doing that type of work to be able to just put my hands in dough and squeeze it. It's just
absolutely. It is funny. A couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, I don't remember when, somebody, I was in the process of getting it started and somebody in the house asked me, they said, so when will the bread be ready? And I was like, tomorrow. Right. You've asked me 24 hours in advance. Like this is not pop it in the oven time yet. So, all right, now to get to the topic of the day, not actually sourdough bread, but you proposed the topic of stopping binge drinking in your 40s. Is that what you're ready to talk about today?
Yeah,
let's
sure.
Let's do it. All right. So let's start with this. I'd love for you to take a second and share with us how you define binge drinking so that we're all on the same wavelength.
To me, it is a high functioning alcoholic, somebody who relies on drinking to have fun, to be social, to experience, I would say, their social life.
Okay.
And have it be repetitive to the point of where it's weekly, few times weekly, and it's to excess. So it isn't just having a glass or two of wine, it's having a bottle of wine.
Okay.
And for my little body, that's a lot. And so it might be that, or just having that excess and not really being able to stop until my body stops me.
Okay. All right. Very good. Now let's back up further than this, because the transition is that you stopped doing this, but let's back up sort of to the start and get some history. How old were you when you remember starting drinking?
I was 13.
I think that's, yeah, I think that's pretty normal. I mean, other people might disagree, but seems like around the age
Sadly
where,
normal.
right. Well, I mean, I say that without judgment. Like if you said seven, I might be like, okay, that seemed early. But so now we'll talk about so what did you enjoy about drinking? Like what was the benefit or what was the purpose that it served for you in your life?
The surface benefits were feeding my rebellion and just feeling like, oh, I'm doing something naughty, and being able to feed that side of me. The deeper things that it was providing me was a salve to my social anxiety and to my feelings of inadequacy and like, I'm not knowing who I was and having disconnection from myself. And it helped to deepen that gap of that disconnection. I had experienced a lot of childhood trauma. And so by the time I got to 13 and kids were experimenting with alcohol, I wasn't abnormal in that respect. But like those who I think end up taking it too far, I was using it for courage, or I was
Yeah.
using it to feel okay at parties and with boys. I was using it to come out of my shell
Yeah.
and not, and instead of maybe how others might. I mean, I think a lot of kids probably start out that way, but it doesn't escalate necessarily for them. But for me, it did because I was masking a lot of deep, deep pain.
Okay. All right. So, now we're gonna talk about the very end of the story, and then we're going to dive into the shift. I wrote these questions out, and apparently, I was shifting time a lot as it goes, but I think this will work. We're going to talk about the end. You told me that you stopped binge drinking. Tell me what that means in a little more detail. Does this mean that you are sober?
It means that I don't binge drink. So
Okay.
I am an occasional drinker where I may have a glass of wine, a beer, very occasionally. It's usually celebratory. Something is, here's a glass of champagne to celebrate this thing. It's happened in that respect since I quit binge drinking. I've had alcohol medicinally since I've
Okay.
quit binge drinking. Alcohol, just the very short and inadequate history, because I don't know the full history, but it really started out as an analgesic, a pain reliever, and medicinal. And a lot of people then started using it socially and started using it regularly rather than medicinally, or was a way to purify water so
That's
that
the
you
way I
could drink
understood it.
it.
Right, exactly. Like it
Yeah,
was
but
like in,
then,
yeah.
it becomes a problem if that's all you're drinking,
Right.
and
So,
it
like in
becomes a
the time
problem.
of cholera, we drank beer and wine because the water would kill you.
And it becomes a problem when the medicine that may be a pain reliever is used also more regularly.
Yes.
So for me, it really did help to relieve some pain, mental and emotional pain.
Yep.
Really, I didn't have physical pain at the time, but mental and emotional stuff. And so that was something that I used it for, and then it got to a point where it was used very regularly to the point of not being, it was interfering with my life and it
All
was
right.
interfering with my work and my parenting. And it got to that point of where, I had that come to Jesus moment with it.
Okay. All right. And we'll talk about that in a second because that is part of the story. But before we move past this, and I have no judgment about any of these things, and as I ask these questions, I'm in neutral Nelly. Where does this fall in? Just because we're talking about sobriety and we're talking about binge drinking, do you have any opinion or any rules that you made for yourself on other things that people use? And in Arkansas, I don't know what the rules are, but like cannabis, psychedelics, sleep aids, caffeine, pain meds, spiritual stuff like ayahuasca, which I do not know how to spell for the record, and any of those things.
Good luck with this
Where,
show notes.
right, exactly. Good luck to the AI machine as it tries to figure out how to spell that. But where do you have any opinions about that, or is it a totally separate thought process for you?
My opinions lie in that all these substances can be beneficial At times, and for specific use cases and at specific moments in life, I don't think any of them are necessary for a life, for a healthy, lovely, amazing life. I don't think any of them are necessary. So then it's a point of deciding, well, what unnecessary things and at what volume am I going to have those unnecessary things in my life? Is it going to be immediately necessary for something, whether that's pain relief or I need to break through this block that I have that no other thing has broken through. And someone told me that ayahuasca is the thing that would help me break through that. I have no problems with people, and well, people can do anything they want. For me, you know,
Right. Be really just you.
yeah, I mean, for me, it's that I've gotten to a place because I've done just about every substance you can imagine, and most of them on an experimental level, some of them on a more behavioral addictive level. And I've just gotten to a point of where this version of me doesn't find any of those things necessary to feel a certain way, to approach a certain situation, to have a certain experience. But have I had those? Yes. And have I found benefit in many of those things? Absolutely, yes. So I would never draw any judgment on anyone wanting to do any of those things. The problem for me, again, came in the binge aspect of it, of not being able to curb the behavior of really being an unconscious participant in the ingestion of said substance rather than having an intentional experience with a substance. I believe all these substances can be beneficial and can have a place in someone's life, but the intention has to be there too.
Yeah, I love that. I think you said that really well. That question was partially inspired by when one of so I grew up with the in school messaging DARE, DARE, which I forget what it actually stands for. We used to joke that it stood for drugs are real expensive. I don't remember what it actually stands for, but my children, when they went through all four of them, one of them took that message totally to heart, and they had gone through the elementary school presentation, and they came home, and then they had like a fever, and I was trying to give them medicine for their fever to bring their fever back. So, and they were like, "I can't take this because this is drugs," and we just had this presentation about drugs, and I was like, "Yes, you did. And I understand that message. And this is not what they meant." And they were like, "Well, how can you explain it?" And I was like, "That is a very good question. But for the moment, please just believe me and take this thimble full of medicine so that you feel better." So that is partly what inspired that question, because it can be a broad topic and everybody's going to weigh in on it in their own way, which is really kind of what I wanted to give you a chance to share your opinions about. So I actually have talked to a good number of people, both socially and professionally, as an interviewer about this shift over the years. I think that sometimes, and this is going to lead into what you were talking about, there is a misconception that every single person who goes through a journey of changing their opinion about drinking goes through exactly the same path and journey to get to their decision. And I am not an expert on this, but I've never actually heard the same story twice, which gives me the opinion that probably everybody has their own unique experience with this, like so many other things. So can you share with us what was going on and what were your thoughts and feelings when your sensation about drinking and binge drinking, to be specific, began to change?
It has so much to do with the things I was missing out on and neglecting in my life, and also things that started to, like I said, interfere with work and my health. So I was in my early 40s when I stopped that habit and that behavior. So I had spent from 13 to 40, 30 years drinking, and early on, 13 to maybe 15, 16. It wasn't heavy,
Right.
but pretty much my late teens until I was in my early 40s, I'm talking fairly heavy drinking. I grew up in New England, New Hampshire, known for drinking. No, there's a lot of people who would call that behavior normal because that's how they grew up too. We drank heavy, we cussed, we fought. I didn't fight, but there were a lot of fights going on, fist fights. It's just a lot of really aggressive energy, aggressive with your body. You're just doing keg stands and funneling beers and doing a lot to prove, I think, your personhood. You could say manhood, but it wasn't just men, it was women too, girls too. We were all there to prove something, prove how much we could push ourselves. And that behavior was such a long period that I just got used to it. I got used to being that way. And I think our society is also set up in a way of where alcohol is so normalized that you are given it at every function. If you're an adult and you go to a baby shower, you're given alcohol. You go to, the bowling alley and you can drink beers. You can go and every brunch, it's drinks. Every place that you go to socialize and be with other adults and have fun and let loose and play and be social, drinking is typically involved, drinking alcohol. So it's very easy for that habit, that behavior to just continue and also potentially snowball. And so for me, it had snowballed to the point of where I was putting myself in danger or at risk and really not being as intelligent as I am. I was ignoring my own inner knowing. I was ignoring my own intelligence, and I was ignoring my family and ignoring my responsibilities for work to the point of where it wasn't cool anymore. And it just was not anything that I wanted to see continued. So I stopped immediately. It wasn't hard for me. It was really just a decision. Okay, that's got to stop. This
Okay.
crazy.
Was
And
there a single incident that you remember right before you just where your will became stronger than your want? Like where was there anything that specifically happened that is the last moment of this?
yeah, I was in New York City. I was there visiting a friend, and we, as you might do in New York City, if you're like me or like I was, we partied until, about 4:30 in the morning.
In your 40s, that's
In my
impressive.
40s. In my 40s. Yeah, I'm a mother. I'm a wife. I have, I was a professional career woman, or I still am, but I had an actual job at the time. I was not self-employed like I am now. I was both, but I was holding that. And I was out at a bar until that time, like dancing on the bar, just drinking with strangers and my friend. We were having what we felt was a great, fun time. We stumble back to her apartment, and my car was parked out in front of her building. And I look to where I was drunk, but I wasn't this drunk. I'm like, my car's gone. What happened to my car? And then I'm questioning myself, did I park here? Am I that drunk? Where's my car? And I had trusted her guidance in where I could park. If you've ever parked in New York City, there's like a gazillion signs that all say different things, and you're like trying to decipher what this means. She lived there though, and she said I could park there overnight. So I just believed her. She was unaware of where I parked being a no standing zone, which means you can never stop. You're not even supposed to pull over there,
Right.
even though people do and like let somebody out, but you're not supposed to stop there at all. That's what no standing means. And I was in a no standing zone. My car got towed, and I had to go and recover this car pretty much still drunk. I mean, I slept for maybe 2 hours, got up, went to the tow yard, head just hanging in shame, just going, I can't believe I did this. I can't believe I'm smarter than this. I am more responsible than this, really. I am truly better than this, but I'm not acting like it. So, how can I actually say I'm better than this? How can I actually claim that I'm smarter than this. I can't.
Because it
I can't
happened.
unless I don't do that. You know, it's
Yeah.
basically like the behavior's got to match what I believe I think I am in order for me to truly stand behind it. And I wasn't. I was totally out of integrity. And that was it. That was the moment I.
So getting your car towed was the moment. I mean, those signs in New York City are very confusing. In most cities, just yesterday, I parked for something and I was looking at the sign and there was a parking. Now we use the app. So there's the parking app sign, and directly underneath it was a sign with the arrow that said no parking, pointing to everywhere, just generally like never park anywhere kind of sign. And I looked up and I, you know, it looked like it had been tilted a little bit and it had been shifted. And I was doing the thing you do where you look around and you're like, well, other people are parking here. Like, what do we think the rules are? And how willing am I to take this risk? Does this really look like it's a neighborhood where they're going to come? Like, doing the parking algebra. So I think that, but they're getting your car towed is an experience that nobody wants to repeat. It's a giant pain. So that was the incident right before you began to change your behavior. So you mentioned this. For you, this was a decision followed by an immediate shift in behavior. You said it was not hard to do. What was, describe the beginning of this. This is just, you made a decision. I was doing this and now I'm going to do something else. I mean, that is with behavior change, there is a moment where we stop, whether it's, you know, I'm sitting and now I'm going to be standing up, you know, all there is a moment where we change behavior. But talk to us a little bit about what the beginning of this shift was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, because it's a collection of moments, that car towing experience, where if that was the only one thing that ever happened in my these all of the collective experiences of me being a irresponsible binge drinker
I mean, a
partier.
lot of people are on that list if it's parking in the wrong spot and getting
yeah,
your car
no, I
towed.
mean, if
Like,
that was the only thing that had ever
I've
happened,
done that sober.
I,
So, you know.
Yeah. Maybe there'd be some great, I would give myself some grace. I mean, I give myself grace anyway, but it's just, it was that straw that broke the camel's back. It was so shameful that I had gotten to this point of where I wasn't taking responsibility for that in the true sense of the word. It was both responsibility for my car and then for my money, because it costs a lot of
Oh,
money
so
to get your,
expensive.
you know, a car out of the tow. I almost missed my flight because I had to drive back up to Connecticut to catch a flight, and I had to do all of that first. And it was just it was a symbolic thing, really, that was a shameful symbolic moment. That was the capper to many shameful moments that had been happening over the course of, I would say, a decade. So pretty much the fun of partying and drinking into my early 30s was just like, okay, well, I'm doing this. I had some scary moments in my 20s and some risky behavior and things that were not great. My early days of partying and drinking did get to the point of being so bad that I was thinking, and it wasn't because of drinking and drugging. That's a complete behavior that I was self-medicating with. But I got to a point where I was thinking about suicide, not ever planning it, but starting to feel like life is awful. I feel awful. I had no idea why I felt that way. It felt completely hopeless. And I got to a point of that drinking and drug taking of where that wasn't working anymore and it was becoming part of the problem. So it felt like a rock bottom, and it was a rock bottom.
Yeah.
It's ended some of those behaviors, but it didn't end the drinking. The drinking continued until I, like I said, really early 40s. So all between that time period, I of essentially 2 decades, it was very unconscious behavior. I was, on the one hand, going to therapy, doing a ton of alternative healing work, was working in that space, was very much focused on my growth and my own evolution on the one hand. And then it was like weekend party me. My weekend would start sometimes on a Tuesday, but it was weekend party me that would then kick in. And it was like I was Jekyll and Hyde. I was just completely forgotten about all that work I had done on myself, for my healing. And I would just let it all go and let loose.
And so it was years and years and years before you were willing to do this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, years of when I knew this isn't really how I want to live. I mean, I would say a decade of where I knew this isn't really how I want to be. This is not how I want to best show up. I did when I decided, my husband and I decided to have a baby. I stopped drinking then. Again, easily. Wasn't like, oh God, this is going to be hard for me and I need my mommy juice and all of this. It wasn't that type of thing. It was just, it felt like a welcome relief, honestly. Like I had this excuse to do that. What I didn't realize at the time is that I never put myself in that reason box. I used, oh, I can have my son. I'm going to have my son. I want to be a wonderful mom, have a healthy body for this experience. And that was a big enough excuse or reason for me. But I never put myself in that. This is a big enough reason for me. Just
so
my
like
own
this,
health.
Right. Self-worth. A long time ago, I interviewed a guy whose name is John Young, and he was talking about fitness. And he was talking about how he was not making the decision to get in shape and not making the decision. And then the way he said it, he said, then one day my will to do it became stronger than my won't. Like it was like, I'm not going to do it. And so it's like the day the moment you decide that, you know, my will to take care of myself, prioritize my health, whatever it is, exceeds my desire to not do that is kind of when we make the switch. Yeah. And it's hard to manufacture that. Until the time.
It is. Well, there's work that goes into creating that version of you that has that will. It doesn't come from nowhere. It doesn't come from a magic silver bullet or from somebody else's system or formula. It is truly, I believe, a transformation that you must go through to get to this version of you that has the will or that no longer desires the drink and is that new aspect or that new version of you.
What has been the toughest part of this change, if anything, for you?
Nothing's been hard about it in the quitting, let's say, or the resisting, or not having drinks or drinks, as we would say, right? Going to brunch or the bar. Nothing was hard about that. I would say that some friendships fell away.
Okay.
And those friendships that were the substantive thing about those friendships was the partying.
And
And
the pattern.
That's where we connected and the spaces that we bonded in were that. And I couldn't relate to them anymore and have that connection anymore. So I won't say losing friendships because I don't feel a loss about it, but there's a certain sadness to going, oh, that's all that was.
Yeah. It is a challenge, right? It is a challenge in any kind of behavior modification. You know, if you want to become a rock climber and you don't know anybody who rock climbs, the easiest way to do that is to go and find a group of people who are rock climbing. If you are a member of a intense fitness gym, and you leave that gym, you may not see those people as much if that's the only thing you have in common. If you also go to knitting club with those same people, you'll still keep seeing them, but if the only thing you have in common is that. And we use that advice all the time, right? We use that advice all the time in personal development, in business things. It's like, oh, the people you hang around with, the five people you hang around with, that's who's going to pull you up. But you can cross apply that to lots of different things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a catchier message than others is my point. Sometimes we like it and sometimes we're like, no, I don't know if I like it over there, but it's probably still true all those times. A lot of times when I'm talking to people about changes they've made in their life and choices and decisions, I asked them about support, but I'm going to actually ask you about inspiration. Was there anybody or anything during this process of redefining and transitioning your behavior around this that inspired you on your journey?
My husband and son both inspired me. My husband and I both quit binge drinking at the same time. So we met in our party days where we were partying hard together and having a blast. And that was, you know, thankfully, we had much deeper substance than that to share with one another. So he was not one of the ones that fell away. But that was a deep source of inspiration of just looking at them and knowing I wanted to be a better wife and mother.
Very nice. All right. So in a minute, we're going to do the final questions, final fun questions. But I want to give you a chance to tell people who are listening and watching about what you do and how they can find you online.
I do a few different things, but really mainly I'm a spiritual guide. I help people discover their true essence and connect to that deepest inner truth of who they really are. And I do that mostly through my podcast. It's called The Everyday Mystic. And we also have a membership and programs and retreats you can find on theeverydaymystic.org. I've married that spiritual guidance work with business mentorship because my professional life has all been in business consulting, business advising, as well as the building of my own companies. So I take and marry those two things and help entrepreneurs approach being an entrepreneur from a spiritual and energetic place.
Beautiful. The Everyday Mystic. So we'll put that in the show notes, of course. And the easiest way to find these links and remember these things is to be a subscriber to my email community at imperfectadulting.com. Can't recommend it highly enough. Anyway, now where it's time for the final three questions. These are rapid fire. The idea is that they're just fun. Just say whatever comes to mind. No pressure. This is kind of a ridiculous question. I wrote that down when I wrote the question. But I'm asking it anyway. Okay. Thinking back over your whole entire life, what year, what age is your favorite? How old were you? And fine print, you're not allowed to pick right now. Some other time in your life.
Ugh, that's tough because it is right now.
No, but you have to pick another one other than right now, because obviously that's the best. But other than right now, looking back, what's your favorite?
Yeah. I would say my other favorite age would have been sometime around 5 or 6.
Okay.
And having a sense of freedom to play that I'm still learning how to get back.
All right. That is a great answer. That is a great answer. A little deep. All right, very good. Now, if you are stuck on a desert island, an imaginary desert island, not one that actually exists, this is all pretend. You have no TV and you have no radio, but you can only have one book. This is another ridiculous question. Apparently, I was in a phase of ridiculous questions as I wrote these out. Okay, so no TV, no radio. You're on a desert island. You can have one book, just one book. What book do you pick?
That's also a really tough one, Amy. That
apparently,
is.
Apparently, I came up with really hard, random questions.
They're hard because there's a lot of choices. The first one, the first thing that came to mind was The Four Agreements.
Okay.
And I say that because it's such a simple message, but I go back to it all the time. So I feel like, it's been with me for 30 years and I've continued to go back to it. And I'll stick with that.
Yeah, no, I think so. The first one that comes to mind. I think that that's a great answer. I mean, there is no wrong answer. It's just for fun. There's no prize or penalty. All right, so last one. This one really is hopefully very easy. Do you prefer sweet or salt or savory, like salty snacks? And can you share one of your favorite treats that you enjoy?
Sweet chocolate.
Okay.
So yeah, milk chocolate. For me, I was a dark chocolate person for a long time because I think I've felt like it was healthier or chicer, or like, oh yeah, you know, everyone loves dark chocolate. Like, it's okay if you have dark chocolate, but really, it's the sweeter milk melt in your mouth chocolate that I can't get enough of.
That you love. All right. Milk chocolate. That is very cool. All right. That's it. Carissa St. Laurent, thank you so much. You've been a wonderful guest on the show today.
My pleasure, Amy. Happy to be with you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.